This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. L.A. McCray sees beer as a ministry. She's the owner of Black Star Line Brewing Company in Hendersonville, North Carolina. And for her, a brewery is an opportunity to cultivate a community one pint at a time. L.A. grew up about 30 miles outside of Baltimore. She was involved in her church at a young age. And she learned about the work of activists like Audre Lorde and Stokely Carmichael through that church. At her brewery, L.A. has named beers after civil rights leaders, part of Black Star Line's mission to combine beer with conversations about social justice. The brewery also specializes in beers that use herbs and other ingredients similar to traditional African styles. Black Star Line is Western North Carolina's first black-owned brewery, and its owner, L.A. McCray, joins me now from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. L.A. McCray, welcome to State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me more about this brewery and the recipes, too, and traditional African styles. Tell me about those recipes.
Yeah, so I first and foremost just want to say thank you again for having me on the radio today. It's my mom's birthday, so happy birthday to Mama D. We have one of our most popular beers that's named after my mom, and my mom is not a beer drinker. However, she said, I'm looking, if I was going to drink a beer, I would want this, this, and this. And, you know, she nailed it the first time. So thank you and happy birthday, Ma.
Wait a minute. This, and this. What, and what does your mom want?
I can't
beer?
Tell you. It's a secret, right? I can tell you that my mom loves chocolates, though. So it definitely has chocolate.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, again, it's and about these other recipes that go back to really ancient African traditions. Beer making goes back a long way, and it starts in its earliest days. We can find it in Africa, right?
We can. So the first fermenters came out of the Mesopotamia River Valley culture, and we were looking at women whose role was to go down to the river and bring water back up. So it was there at the really the core of civilization as we know it that we had some of the earliest fermented drinks. Fermented. We'll be flexible with that word today.
I like furliest myself. I love a furly beer. That's what I look for in a beer. But tell me more about this, because this is it's fascinating stuff. And the role of women, the idea that these herbs that were part of the fermentation and fermenting food in the first place was really, we owe all of that and probably our survival as a result to some of those earliest experiments in fermentation, right?
Right. So hops, as an addition, comes relatively recent in terms of our culture and history as brewers. Before that, we would use various types of herbs and spices that would actually be fermented together. So from that culture, you know, we experiment with gruits, looking at various herbs, the medicinal purposes of herbs. There's definitely ways to use herbs and spices and all sorts of things in these fermented beverages so that they really address our holistic selves. And that's really what we're looking to do, especially in our botanical line and as we continue to develop and refine our recipes.
You develop and refine. To what extent do you know about some of the older recipes? How much is brought forward and how much are you inventing based on your knowledge of what went on a long time ago?
Yeah, so I'll respond to that by giving you a brief story about our family history. This spring, my grandmother and a couple other family members were in the hospital. So when my grandmother was in the hospital, I was sitting there by her bedside with my Aunt Georgie May. And that's when I learned about our family history and brewing. Of course, they said, you know, it was that good old home brewing out there in the country. And from then, my Aunt Georgie was telling me about a dandelion beer and, you know, all sorts of things and things I never would have even considered. But you're looking at beer as being a resiliency drink and a drink of collective liberation. These were folks in the country who were using what they had really to cultivate community, to have good times, but it was a practice for them, right? It was like a spiritual practice. So similarly, we hold that type of feeling when we go into a brew cycle. As an ordained, theologically trained preacher, I'm sure Simon and folks from the team can say how they've heard our playlist, our gospel playlist when we're brewing. And, you know, there will be times we'll just be talking and thinking about names and I'll go into full preacher mode. So there's definitely a spirit and energy. God is always present with us. So Yeah, it definitely differentiates us from other breweries.
And quite clearly, you are very intentional about this brewery. Presumably, you're making good beer, but you're quite intentional about some of the other ideas around the brewery. Black Star Line, just for starters. I mean, tell us about where the name comes from.
Yeah, so Black Star Line was started in 1919 in Delaware, not too far from where I grew up in Bel Air, Maryland, by Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And most people haven't heard of Garvey or the UNIA, but are very familiar with the Montgomery Improvement Association, which was a chapter of the UNIA. So when we look at naming a brewery, just like naming a child, right, we really want to hold this infant and help it mature into what all of its potential could be. So for us, Black Star Line Brewing Company was really reclaiming that heritage that Marcus Garvey left us with, and looking at ways that we could use something like beer as a vehicle for not just a social movement, but as a vehicle for collective liberation, collective healing, and collective economics. So for us, clearly at the core is making really great beer, making sweet beer, maltier beers. If we think about beers that were made in Africa, they were definitely much more sweeter and definitely less hop forward. So that's really what we're looking to cultivate in the beer. And then in our brewery, it really is a community. It definitely gives you that church vibe. We have our regulars and we've grieved together. We've laughed together. We've cried together. We've played spades together. Of course, I've won. But, it really is a different type of community. It's a community space where all people are welcome. This isn't about saying who is and isn't welcome. It's a whosoever brewery. Everyone's welcome, regardless of your doctrines, dogmas, creed. It's a place for everyone.
All right, well, let's see how all of these themes came together in a brewery called Black Star Line in Hendersonville. Take us back to your roots. What was it? You grew up in Bel Air, Maryland, outside of Baltimore, right?
I did.
Well, tell us about growing up there. The church was very important to you.
It was indeed. So I grew up at Ames United Methodist Church and really came into my political understanding due to the activism that was going on in the church. Miss Maisie Taylor founded the Black Youth in Action, which wasn't about, having us do fun things, even though we did. It was more about having us being politically conscious. You know, the young folks today would say being woke and helping us to understand our social location in the world. So from being involved with United Methodist Youth Foundation, UMYF, United Methodist Women, I would tag along with my dad to United Methodist Men. I was in lay speaking, an acolyte, a liturgist. So really inundated in the connectionalism of the United Methodist Church. And through that experience, especially growing up through Black Methodists, we had Black Methodists for Church Renewal, BMCR. It was our responsibility, because we were given a privilege, to be involved in this community that had literally a world outreach. So it was very common for us to be talking about the differences and, our social positioning and looking at our socialization and the ways that we can show up in the world to leave the world better than what we found it. You know, theologians will say the beloved community. And for us, it was about holding space in a particular type of way and definitely living into our heritage and our legacy. So, I brief shout out to the Reverend Dr. C. Anthony Hunt, Reverend King, all of the pastors that really walked with me and all of the other folks, the young folks in our congregation that helped us understand our history, our legacy, and our responsibilities as social activists. You know, faith without works is dead, as some folks certainly, I believe. And we look at passages from the Hebrew Bible, Isaiah. I was able to work on Capitol Hill at the United Methodist Building with the General Board of Church and Society. So for me, being a Methodist, being raised as a United Methodist, really goes back to the roots of John and Charles Wesley, of Susanna Wesley. You know, it was John Wesley who's often quoted with saying, "Catch on fire with enthusiasm so that people from miles away will come to watch you burn." And looking at the Wesleyan principles as expressed in the United Methodist Church, truly it's about being the people of God for all people, regardless of if you believe in God, the Christian God. It's about being able to articulate what a liberation theology looks like by doing those works.
And you were able to articulate this apparently at a very early age, at the age of 10, when you gave your first sermon. Is that right?
did. It was my birthday, so it was March 10th, and it always falls on the weekend where we jump an hour early in daylight savings. So as typical, my dad and I, my friend Courtney White, spent the night. We got up, went to Burger King, and I was the acolyte that day. I was the liturgist, and I gave my first sermon, which was called Touched by an Angel. Clearly, I was of that generation where Touched by an Angel was still, you know, a popular show.
Right. Well, tell, what'd you say? Give us a, I've got about 30 seconds for you to summarize that, and then we'll take a break.
I don't remember, but I have that sermon somewhere written, I'm sure.
And you were learning about, your mother was worked as a director of youth for the NAACP as well, right?
She did. So my mother definitely was critical in my political consciousness. We did a lot of activism and work in D.C. and Baltimore. My mom and I would get in the car and go to protests downtown. She took me to the United Nations 50th anniversary celebration with the United Methodist Women in New York City. And she was definitely responsible for me developing my theological interest, my spiritual development. I remember doing the spiritual gifts inventory no less than 15 times. She was the director of our School of Christian Mission, our Youth School of Christian Mission, and, you know, always helped me to understand my role and responsibility because of the privileges that we had, and made sure that we were always, always, always moving the needle forward. You know, it was Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that said the arc of the universe is long, right? But it bends towards justice. And my mother and my father really are responsible for helping me to understand my role in bending that arc.
We're going to take a break right now, talking with L.A. McCray, an ordained minister and the owner of Black Star Line Brewing Company in Hendersonville, North Carolina. Our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest is L.A. McCray. She's the owner of Black Star Line Brewing Company in Hendersonville, North Carolina, Western North Carolina's first black-owned brewery, specializing in sweet beers using herbs and other ingredients that would be similar to traditional African styles. And before the break, L.A., you're talking about the birth of your activism and how it became inflamed in you, along with your religious beliefs in the Methodist Church, United Methodist Church. We talked about your first sermon at the age of 10. Now tell us about your first sit-in that you organized in second grade. Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, it was second grade. I was sitting at what was called the bad table, which the kids in school would call it the black table. There was only a handful of black kids, and I was always just at this table. I don't even know if I needed to be at the table, but that's where I was. It developed a relationship with the lunch ladies and our custodian, Mr. Leo, and they were frustrated that they were not being paid well. I was frustrated that we only had 18 minutes for lunch. Often we'd go to get milk and there would be cold milk or milk that would have ice in it or it'd be expired. Also, there wasn't pride and dignity for the kids who were receiving free or reduced lunches. There were these pink slips that they had to use, and it made it very clear that they were separate and different in the cafeteria. So I went to my my class, I got up from the bad table, which I knew I was going to get in trouble for, and told my class that here are our demands. We are not moving. We will sit in silence until our demands are met. Of course, this spreads all across the cafeteria. Mr. Hagenboo, the school principal, comes in with the head teacher, Ms. Savaki, and the vice principal. They ask what's going on. You know, I gave them our demands, which was more time for lunch, having kids be involved in the planning of our menus. Definitely raises for all of the custodians and our staff, who most of the lunch ladies were actually kids' parents. So this was directly related to the kids that I was playing with after schools. So we sat and they called the parents. And that night they had an emergency PTA meeting. And the result was that they increased our time for lunch. We had a brand new system for, you know, inventorying the milk. Harford County Public Schools went to a program where instead of using these pink slips and the IOU slips, we had these digital cards, which was really cool. We also, of course, got the raises for the folks that needed it. And we had this program that was instituted called a Lunch Buddies program. So kids from the cafeteria in each class would volunteer every day to help the lunch ladies and the custodians in the cafeteria. So that was some pretty early activism.
You said, of course. You were 7 years old. There's no of course when a seven-year-old organizes a sit-in.
Well, my parents wouldn't have expected anything less.
They called your parents, didn't they?
They did. They called my dad, and my dad came down. My dad was serving at the PTA at the time, and I remember very clearly that PTA meeting that evening.
What about what happened when they came in?
So the parents came. The parents came in. They sat with us. The parents began
they joined
to...
the protest.
They did. They joined the protest. The parents began to strategize with themselves and took a look at the milk system, which was terrible. Yeah. Imagine eating, like, broccoli and really old milk and then going to free play. No 7-year-old deserves that. So, of course, we had to get some changes.
But how did you think – and again, I want to talk more about this bad table. What was the demographic makeup? Were you one of few African-Americans in that school? Is that what you're saying?
So at the time, it was me, Mike Hunter, Ebony, and maybe 2 or 3 other black kids in the whole school at Ring Factory Elementary School. So generally what would happen is the bad table or the black table was sat at the front of the cafeteria so everyone could see you sitting at this table facing the wall. You had to eat your lunch in silence and you couldn't talk to any other people.
Oh, but this is directly designed to make you feel like you have no rights at all, to say nothing of the ability to perhaps organize a protest. What made you where did that come from?
I'm imagining it came from, you know, my parents, yeah. Our church, looking at the activism we were doing. As a 7-8-year-old, I was really opposed, still opposed to the death penalty, capital punishment. So my mom would often drive me down to Baltimore City and I'd have my little picket signs outside of the jail where they were, you know, fulfilling these death penalties. And so it just was in me. I would not have thought of doing anything other than that.
Yeah, by the 5th grade, you helped organize a group that could be known as SNCC, though it was not. It was the Student Nature Center Committee. Tell us about
that's
your
right.
version
so
of
SNCC. So Billy Hughes, Lauren McDonald, Nivi Ramesh, and myself were done with our curriculum early at the end of 4th grade. So they gave us an option to design our own curriculum, so we did. And we had a beautiful nature center behind our school at Ring Factor Elementary School. We were looking for names on how do we name this, how do we get more people involved. So, of course, being the baby activist, I said, it has to be named SNCC, S-N-C-C. And, of course, my mom assisted me with that. And it became the Student Nature Center Committee. And it's still there today, which is pretty awesome.
Did anybody else know did you have to tell everybody what the reference was?
Of course. Yeah. Of course. I don't think even the teachers probably knew.
What was the reaction? I mean, by 2nd grade, you've already, you know, established yourself as a troublemaker. What kind of relationship did you have with the school and your teachers? Apparently quite good. I mean, the fact is you're doing your schoolwork and you're getting that done early. They're letting you design your own curriculum. So I guess you didn't rub them the wrong way.
It was a very interesting relationship. You know, there's a book that actually addresses these issues called Pushouts about the criminalization of young black girls in public schools. And so, you know, even from pre-kindergarten at Kitty Academy all the way up through high school, it was always a paradox. It was an interesting dichotomy. And it's no different than W.E.B. Du Bois would say, right? There's this double consciousness of constantly looking outside and within oneself and having this veil. So for me, you know, whether it was getting in school suspension, out of school suspension, in middle school, I had to come in early every day. I had a behavior contract. My homeroom was the office. I was on a hallway restriction. I had very specific places where I could sit in the class. I had lunch detention, after school detention, Saturday morning assistance program, and janitor duty, all while getting the president's award, getting great grades, you know, all of this stuff. So it definitely continued to shape me politically and looking at the ways that we as a society, by our own bias, prejudice, bigotry, internalized racism, homophobia, all of that, act in particular ways that Audre Lorde would say are the master's tools, right? So at a very early age, I had my own tangible experiences with this and wanting to dismantle it from within.
But you had a consciousness of it. I was going to ask you about how important it is, because other kids who go through that don't come out the same way, perhaps because they don't have the consciousness, the kind of metaconsciousness that you did about a movement that and people like W.E.B. Du Bois commenting on what exactly you're going through. How does the consciousness of all of that as you're going through this help you through it?
Well, I was definitely a poet. So I used to write under Lady Ariel. That used to be my pen name. And so I would write about it. I would write plays about it. I know that at one point I was a huge environmentalist. And in the 4th grade, I believe, my mom and I were going to summer camp, United Methodist Summer Camp. and I wrote an entire play that we performed about litter bugs, right? I wrote another play that we performed at a church about, you know, what our collective future could be. So for me, it's always been the arts as a pathway to really expressing these things that we're dealing with in our culture and society. And I think another aspect of this is being fully present with it and having a really great council of elders, wise counsel who would help me process it and understand it and not get stuck in that situation. I could have just been stuck in homeroom detention instead. Right. I remember people from my church giving me things to read from Richard Wright, Ivan Bansertima, all of that. So, you know, I would sit there reading, writing, thinking. My brother, my eldest brother, whose birthday is in 3 days, would send me books by Toni Morrison and, you know, Paulo Freire. So it's like I was constantly taking these opportunities of being set aside, of being other, to develop myself.
You went to the University of Tennessee for undergrad. Tell us why
I
you
did.
Chose
I'm
to.
I'm a proud volunteer.
Well, tell us why you chose to go there.
The short answer is I wanted to play basketball for Pat Summitt. So I am a huge basketball fan. I've coached basketball. I've played basketball. I was dragged by a car and 18 months later hit by a truck. So that sort of ended my abilities to play basketball, but still wanted to go be a part of that culture. My mom's family is from all East Tennessee, so I wanted to be really with family and be able to root with family in a different type of way that I hadn't been able to living in Maryland. And really, it was about basketball. I could have gone anywhere else, but I definitely chose the University of Tennessee, Knoxville.
It's a little bit close to the family as well. So this should now, at this point, if you've been listening to this conversation, this will not come as a surprise to you. You finished undergrad in 2.5 years, right? You got it done quickly. What motivated you to get finished in just 2.5 years?
Yeah, so my mom told me the same thing that her parents told her. When I was 16, she sat me down and said, listen, you have three options. You can go to school, you can get a job, or join, you know, the military. So I took that very seriously. I knew that I needed to get scholarships. So I received tons of scholarships. And just growing up, my parents definitely were not strict, but it was clear that the priority, of course, faith, family, and being productive members of society that had a passion and were actually doing things in our communities. So when I went to school, I was able to transfer in a lot of my AP credits. I tested out of some classes. I was delayed a semester because I donated a kidney to my uncle, but I still finished early Phi Beta Kappa and 8 other honor societies. Of course, we were raising trouble on campus at times as well. So the activism continued on campus.
L.A., your story is one of the few where donating a kidney is put in parentheses as you tell the rest of the story. I just want to say that to say parenthetically, I donated a kidney. It slowed me down a little bit. So let's talk about that protest. There was a protest, yet another, right? And this was in favor of a professor who didn't get tenure. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there were many protests when I was an undergrad at University of Tennessee, Knoxville. But in this case, we still have an African-American studies department. And I was a part of the African-American studies department, double major political science, Africana studies. And one of the professors, absolutely phenomenal, we had really great professors, was denied tenure. You know, we can get into the conversations about academia and all of that, but ultimately, he was denied tenure and given someone else with less qualifications, with less experience, who had not published at the same level, was given tenure. So by this professor not getting tenure, his entire family had to move, and his wife was the dean of the law school. So the Black students got together, some of the athletes got together, and to be Black at UT, everybody knows everybody, whether you're an athlete, whether you're not an athlete. So we all came together. The Omegas, Omega Psi Phis, I was really good friends with a lot of the Omegas. So we're sitting there in the yard and trying to figure out what we need to do. So we decided we were going to walk out of class and drop our books, which in retrospect was ridiculous. We paid for these books. Nevertheless, we walked out of class. We went down to the president's office. And we were there. There was a couple hundred of us outside. We were there all night. We were there to the next morning, demanding that this professor get tenure. But ultimately, you know, it's out of the hands of the students. But at that point, it became clear that just because you have an education does not make you exempt from acts of racism and microaggressions.
How did it turn out?
The professor did ultimately end up leaving, but was really felt the heartfelt connection between the student body and supporting his academic leadership.
You decided to become a minister. You went to Wesleyan Theological Seminary. How long had you known that you wanted to be a minister?
Yeah, I really don't feel like I chose to be a minister. I feel like that's just something that's always been in me. So I remember very clearly I was sitting in my Uncle Robert's kitchen on graduation weekend, deciding which PhD program to go in, and was thinking a little bit about seminary. And it was Reverend Dr. C. Anthony Hunt that called and invited me to come back home to the Baltimore Washington Conference, the United Methodist Church, and go to Wesley Theological Seminary. So that felt in alignment with my soul and my spirit. I went to Wesley and continued to do, of course, activism in the work, which was really on me. I was ordained by Bishop John Selders in the Interdenominational Conference of Liberation Congregations and Ministers. That's a mouthful, but essentially it's the African Orthodox Church. So I went from Methodism back to the Orthodox Church. And, you know, John Wesley went from the Orthodox Church to Methodism. So I did the reverse in a little bit.
Yeah, of course you would do it backwards, but go ahead.
Of course. I couldn't have it any other way.
Tell us about that, because you have spoken so warmly and so fondly about your religion. You went to seminary, but there is a conflict, was there not, between that and your sexual identity at points. Tell us about that.
There is. So the United Methodist Church is one of the largest Protestant movements in the world, and we are ultimately ruled by two things, our Book of Discipline and the Book of Resolutions. So at the time, in the Book of Discipline, there is paragraph 161G, which states that you cannot be a self-ordained practicing homosexual. Jokingly, I told the district superintendent at the time that I wasn't ordained yet and I wasn't practicing. She didn't find that funny. But, you know, at the time, I could not agree to that. I had done so much in my life to be unapologetically who I am. And the people who raised me in the church certainly had a particular type of political consciousness that, you know, you are who you are, and you are called to be who you are, to be a light in the world. And thinking about the University of Tennessee Torchbearers Creed, you know, it's we have to shadow ourselves so that we can shine a light onto others. And I could not, in good conscience, not be who God intended and created me to be, to follow into this system. So I was not able to be ordained in the Methodist Church.
You moved out. So talk about your ordination, where you were ordained, and how you were able to reconcile those.
Yeah, so I was selected as one of 20 seminary students from across the world and received the 2008 Fund for Theological Education Ministry Fellowship. And through that, had an opportunity to meet Bishop John Selders and First Lady Selders. Shout out to First Lady Latte, Maisha, and was able to really develop spiritually in a particular type of way that allowed me to understand my upbringing in the Methodist Church with my social activism, as well as African traditional beliefs, right? That was something that was completely mind-blowing to me, that there's another way to understand faith and the people of faith. And there's actually practices from the coast of Africa that I did not even know about. And there's just learning God in new ways, learning about different ways to talk about God that really deeply resonated with my soul. And it was under the leadership and mentoring of Bishop Selders and First Lady Pam, that I understood my role as, you know, Bishop would say, an urban street guerrilla minister, but I'll say I'm a whiskey drinking, cigarette smoking, real, authentic, sincere pastor who does ministry wherever I am, as ratchet as it may look to other people. Like, that's me showing up in the world as authentically who I am, is the ways that I'm able to connect with folk.
You left out beer making, but okay.
I'll add that one now. Beer making, that's right. That's right.
You came out to your parents at a young age. What was that experience like?
I did. So when I came out to my parents, it was not by choice. It just sort of happened, and had that conversation. And they were, you know, we talked about what that meant spiritually and reconciling with what that means and what that means, you know, for my soul ultimately. But I can honestly say that I've had the most supportive parents at General Conference 2008, which is the quadrennial meeting of the Methodist Church. Methodists make up words like quadrennial. So every 4 years, we have this meeting of the international church. And in 2008, I was sitting there with my dad. My mom was elected one of 1,000 delegates from around the world. So that's already a pretty big deal. And in her silent way, in her silent protest, as the delegates were talking about homosexuals being spawns of Satan, which is a direct quote, my mom just stood silently in solidarity with the entire LGBT community, and that caught on like wildfire. So you had people standing in the stands, you had the delegates standing, and that was a long way. That's a 10-year journey. It's to see my mom go from trying to understand and reconcile my own identity to being literally on the front lines internationally, right, in the Methodist Church, saying that this is a church for all people.
L.A. McRae is the owner of Black Star Line Brewing Company in Hendersonville, North Carolina. And we will continue our conversation on the state of things after this. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with L.A. McRae, the owner of Black Star Line Brewing Company in Hendersonville, North Carolina, Western North Carolina's first black-owned brewery specializing in sweeter beers that use herbs and other ingredients similar to traditional African styles. And I want to talk more about the brewery in just a minute, but I do want to get just to finish up on your education, because you did a post-grad certification at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and I want to know how that experience shaped your approach to activism.
Yeah, so I was honored to be a part of the Reconciling Ministries Network directors team, part of the early RMN movement. And through that, Michelle Blue and I had an opportunity to study directly with Marshall Gons, who developed campaigns for Cesar Chavez and Barack Obama. So we learned how to implement public narrative, the story of me, the story of us, and the story of now, as a way to gather people, as a way to move our movements forward, and really as a way to bring people in. So that was an invaluable experience. I'm so grateful to have learned and studied at the feet of Marshall Gons.
We'll talk more about then starting a brewery. We've heard this, to me, extraordinary story, and it seems to me that you're someone who can do anything. And you've, one of the things you've decided to do, and I guess you're not done yet, is to start a brewery. Why did that idea of all the things you could have done appeal to you so much?
Yeah, so for me, it goes back to my faith, really. Of course, making great beer, but always wanting to cultivate a place for the least of these, for the marginalized, for those who are often ostracized from community. And at a very early age, around 15, I had a dream of creating a place literally called home. So think like the black queer version of Cheers, right? And as this idea began to look differently over time, whether it was cultivating the village, which was the first version of this in Dundalk, Maryland, with my good friend Becky Nellinger in her coffee shop. Later, looking at Tribe, TRY over IBE in Western Massachusetts, always looking at cultivating and holding space for those who often feel like their lives and their stories don't matter. So the brewery just made sense. I fell in love, came across the mountains into Asheville, and this was something that I wanted to do. I had said earlier that year that I really wanted to begin making things and being more industrious. So beer seemed like the perfect vehicle to create not just social change, but to cultivate community in really amazing ways.
The names of your beers, I guess, are part of that. You've named beers for Audre Lorde and Stokely Carmichael. Tell us about that and the kinds of conversations they might generate.
Yeah, so the first beer, I was sitting with my best friend, Lauren Manning, on my porch in Asheville as we were dreaming about Black Star Line Brewing Company. And she said, the first beer has to be a super black, sweet stout. It has to be the Stokely Stout. I was like, yes. So Stokely was our first beer and had its name first. And then after that, it was, we would think about, okay, what style of beer would James Baldwin drink? It would be a pale ale. He would definitely be sitting on a pale ale. So now one of our flagships is the Juicy Jimmy's Pale Ale, which shout out to Javi for kegging that today while we're at the studio. You know, once we made the Lorde Honey Pilsner, we tasted it and we're like, okay, it's black German beer. Of course, this is Audre Lorde's beer, a black German activist, you know, so it just made sense. So each time we make a new beer, we're an intentional, thought, deliberation and for me, prayer about who it is that we want to invoke for our brand. Because our brewery is about bringing more people to the party, right? Carmen Olson with the CBA said that. Kendra, Derek, Joe, and Lisa, our mentors, people who hold us near and dear, are always encouraging us to really bring more people to the party. So we think that these beers and their names definitely evoke a particular type of feeling for folks, and it should be inviting people to come in, to learn more, and to really begin these conversations.
Could it have the opposite effect? To the extent that we still remember or know anything about Stokely Carmichael, could there be those who would say, ooh, I'm not going to touch that beer?
Sure, absolutely. I think that that could be true, but the thing that makes a difference is that it's a damn good beer, right? So because it's a good beer, I think people would come in and have conversations, and that happens all the time. This isn't a brewery or beers aren't named to exclude people, but really invite conversation so that they can understand and feel and taste that this is a whosoever bar.
You have the Pullman Porter, which I think is really inspired, an inspired name.
Yeah, so the Pullman Porter is just, you know, I'm both a preacher and an academician at heart, so I will try to be short with this one. But looking at the history of liberation in this country, in 1895, it was Booker T. Washington who said, "Cast down your buckets where you are. In all matters, we must be as separate as the fingers, but in matters economics, we must be as tight as a fist." Well, less than a year later, in 1896, we had the Plessy v. Ferguson decision, which said, nah, separate is equal. That's cool. Mm. So then there were folks like my grandfather, my mother's father, who are working on the railroads, right? And the Louisiana Accommodations Act said that these folks could work under these conditions, but had to be separate. And of course, the separate conditions that black folks, brown folks, all folks that were not white had to live in were completely different and really uninhabitable. So A. Philip Randolph, who some people may have heard of, one of the architects of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, began to organize these folks who were porters. So when we made the Pullman Porter, we were intentionally thinking about a liberation libation and a resiliency drink that these folks could have been drinking while they're sitting there talking to each other, commiserating, and organizing. I'm sure they were playing spades on these train cars. I can't believe they weren't. So we really wanted to have something that was delicious, brown, sweet, and strong. And that's the story behind our Pullman Porter.
And this is not the first time the connection between breweries and social activism has been made. Talk about Sanctuary Brewing and your partners or the help that you got with that particular organization, that business.
Yeah, so we love Sanctuary Brewing. Big shout outs to Joe and Lisa. They are our near and dear friends. I'm looking forward to watching Fight Club with Lisa this week. You know,
well, tell us more about it. For those of us who may not know enough about it, tell us more.
Yeah, Sanctuary Brewing Company, as far as I know, is one of the first vegan breweries. And it's not so much about being vegan activists. Joe and Lisa are activists first, certainly, who are also vegans. And just knowing them, getting to know them, collectively we call ourselves Blacktuary when we do collaborations, helps me personally to be a better person. There have been dark nights of the soul, as we'll say, and it's been Joe and Lisa who've been there time and time again. So they have Sweet Bear Rescue Farm. If you're listening, I would like to encourage folks to look up Sweet Bear Rescue Farm and make some donations. They're getting some goats in, I believe, today. And so at Sanctuary Brewing Company, everything they do is focused around, again, being a whosoever bar and reducing harm. And so they have a farm, Sweet Bear Rescue Farm, that is a literal sanctuary, not just for animals, but for people. So I would just like to encourage people to check that out for sure.
It sounds great, but I have to tell you, I cannot imagine making beer without meat. Oh, I see. No, it's not that they're vegans, but it has nothing to do with the brewing recipes, right?
No, they're definitely vegans.
Yeah.
And all of the beers are also vegan. So when we think about vegan beers, that means that there's not lactose in them.
Yeah.
It means that they're really intentional about the type of yeast that they use. And this is really about reducing harm and having things that are better for our mind, bodies, hearts, and souls.
Tell us more about the experience and maybe the environment there, craft brewing community in Western North Carolina. What does it look like?
Yeah, so the craft brew community is really a family, and I just feel blessed, humbled, and honored to be a part of the family. Kendra Penland with the ABA, Triskelion, Hillman, definitely Derek Allen. There have been people like The Wedge, New Belgium, Highland, who have opened their everything up to us, helping us to learn how to brew, helping us operationally, Audra and the folks from Mountain Bizworks, helping us to get the skills that we need. So they've welcomed us into the party, and I'm just so grateful and honored to really be here and could not imagine opening a brewery anywhere else.
Now, the business community has been welcoming, but I do understand that you've received a series of racial threats via email since you've opened. Is that right?
Yeah. So when I think about this, I think about, you know, the meta narrative and how that impacts us on a personal level. There is definitely an undertone of racism in this country that's alive and well. But for us, the core goes back to making great beer. So over the next few days, over the following days, when we receive these messages, there was an overwhelming support from the community, from our brewing family, and folks just wanted to come in and taste great beers and support us. And I think that's the main thing, regardless of what folks say or how we differ in our ideologies and political beliefs. What is key is that we're a family, whether you're a family at 131 3rd Avenue West, whether you're part of the Black Shawarey family, whether you're part of the ABA or the Brewers Guild. What's core and critical to this is that we all are in this together.
You taking us back to your family in outside of Baltimore, you really do have a connection with beer. You talked about your relationship with your brothers and their understanding of beer. Tell us about growing up around in a beer culture, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, so you know our family definitely has historically drank beer. My dad used to love getting off work and getting a brewski and watching SportsCenter and Westerns. My eldest brother would take us from our house across the street from Duclaw's, and the three of us would be at Duclaw's. Of course, I was underage, so I got a Shirley Temple. But looking at the ways, even now, one of my, I call him my baby cousins, my baby cousin Drew is working for a brewery in Knoxville. My cousin Brian is on the team as our marketing person. So this really is, from the ground up, a family affair. So yeah, we've all been in it in some ways. And I think it's recently that we're taking that further and using that as an opportunity for us to come together around social enterprise and collective healing for our generational lines.
Let's talk more about that social enterprise and coming together, because I understand that a big part of Black Star Line's mission is to help others, particularly foster Black entrepreneurship. Tell us more.
Yeah, so Joe and Lisa definitely helped incubate us, because without them, you know, I would not know what I know now about brewing. So for us, it's about paying that forward. If, you know, we have a printing press, so helping to encourage, for example, my cousin Brian's kids learning how to use the printing press and incubating them by grassroots reparations, by hands-on mentoring, by helping them to find people who could develop their skills, and looking at ways that collective economics can be done differently. So if you want to have a haircutting business and I'm selling beer, let's figure out a low-cost way for you to start your haircutting business, perhaps in our brewery. And, you know, this goes back to the heart and soul of who we are as people of resilience, right? So my dad, when he came to Bel Air, Maryland, the first thing he did was go to the church. And through that church, he developed network friends that my parents still have. And it was in that community that my dad was able to learn how to drive, get a car, they got their house, all of that stuff. Similarly, that's what the brewery is, right? Like, we are a ministry as much as we are a brewery and social movement. So we want everybody to be winning together.
You know, you talked about studying under Marshall Ganz, who helped with Barack Obama's campaign. But this is somebody who's been busy at the grassroots for a long, long time, talking about grassroots organizing, and probably has a number of successes under his belt, just in terms of the theory of, as you say, telling the story and making sure that people understand which stories are being left out and they're hearing those stories. It's been very successful, but I wonder where you think we are in this moment right now, in terms of whether those narratives have traction anymore. Where are we in terms of organizing and social activism?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks for asking it. I think, you know, what's core and critical now, and I see this more so, is the conversation and the practices around our collective healing and liberation. I know that just this past weekend in Atlanta, Adrienne Marie Brown was leading a group of organizers and activists on grassroots organizing. And the core of this was about healing, an emergent strategy. So I'd like to see the conversation move there versus the narratives that are often divisive. That's not the conversations that we have in our brewery. Sure, these things are happening. What our response is always going back to our social mission, which is collective healing, collective liberation, and collective economics. So I think when we're given those types of narratives, it's our job as stewards of the community, as stewards of the people, to reframe the narratives and look at the ways that we can leverage what's happening so that we can go deeper and build even more authentic community.
But in the past, when those narratives have been successful in creating social change, we have seen perhaps a deeper appetite for understanding those narratives, for mm-hmm. taking fuller narratives in their deeper context and studying a little bit to prepare ourselves and prepare our minds. Are we at a point where our attention is so fragmented that there aren't enough? Maybe there's just not enough bandwidth now. It's so divided to apply the kind of effort it takes to make those narratives have some traction and result in change.
Yeah, so you know I'm a pastor. So in this Advent season, as we're preparing, as we're pausing, as we're reflecting, as we're refining, it wasn't any different than 2,000 plus years ago when our attentions, right? When people's bandwidths were full, when the narrative was one of oppression, where people were living under the constant siege and realities of whatever hierarchy. I don't think it's any different then than it is now. The learning here is our ability to practice and live into our collective resilience and to change that narrative. Tensions will be high because wherever two or more gather, there will be conflict, right? So it's our job to make sure that we're actually living up to our charge, a charge to keep we have, right? And that charge is being peacemakers.
L.A. McRae, what a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining
Likewise.
Us.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
L.A. McRae is the owner of Black Star Line Brewing Company in Hendersonville, North Carolina. She joined us from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. You can find out more about her, her beer, the brewery, and everything else we talked about at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.